You're listening to local and regional news on KMUN. Federal funding for a major hospital expansion project in Astoria disappeared abruptly last year after the Trump administration shut down the program behind the grant. Now, that money may be back on the table. The Oregon Department of Emergency Management announced on Tuesday that it has received new information from the Federal Emergency Management Agency. In a letter to states, tribes, and territories, FEMA says it is resuming key activities around the Building Resilient Infrastructure and Communities, or BRIC, program. This follows successful lawsuits brought by a coalition of states, including Oregon, that argued the closure of the BRIC program last year was unlawful. Columbia Memorial Hospital in Astoria had been awarded a $14 million grant through the program, money that was intended to fund various components of a new building at the Astoria campus to make it resilient in the face of earthquakes, tsunamis, and other natural disasters. The hospital received $6 million from the state legislature in matching funds. CEO Eric Thorson told KMUN the hospital is still waiting on further details about the BRIC award now that the program has resumed operations, but the hospital has not yet received any official communication from FEMA.
We're obviously excited by the news that they were reinstating the BRIC grant program. Details right now are still pretty light.
When the BRIC program was shut down last year, lawsuits immediately followed, and organizations like Columbia Memorial were left in limbo. The hospital opted to proceed with work on the expansion project, saying it couldn't just push pause on the work and the contracts involved. But hospital leaders worried this could threaten the project's eligibility if the BRIC program was restored.
We have maintained, complete compliance with all of the required elements that we're aware of under the BRIC grant program. And we continue to do that today with our project. So there's really not, other than just pure speculation, there's not a lot more I can add until we begin to have those more detailed conversations directly with FEMA. And unfortunately, it's been very, very difficult over the last, really few months to get any answers directly from FEMA. So we're hopeful over the next few weeks that we'll be able to resume our conversations with them and get better guidance and understand if there's any risk to our program or not.
Complicating things now is the ongoing shutdown of the Department of Homeland Security. A spokesperson for the Oregon Department of Emergency Management says grant management software is back up and available for organizations to use, but that the BRIC program will not fully resume programmatic activities until FEMA itself is out of the shutdown. The spokesperson called the news so far a tentative win, but added that Oregon and the organizations due to receive BRIC grant money or reimbursements won't know exactly what that win looks like until FEMA is back up and running. The U.S. Supreme Court is weighing whether to invalidate a Mississippi law allowing officials to accept ballots that arrive after Election Day. That could impact Oregon and Washington, which have similar laws. Dirk Vanderhart reports.
The two states are among 14 that accept mailed ballots that arrive after an election, so long as they are postmarked on or before Election Day. Oregon has only had that policy since 2022, and officials here expect it won't be around much longer. In oral arguments this week, the Supreme Court's conservative majority expressed concerns about Mississippi's policy. The court is expected to rule in June.
If it were to go away, we'd really change nothing. We'd go back to how we did it in 2021.
Dag Robinson is the county clerk in eastern Oregon's Harney County. He's also president of the Oregon Association of County Clerks. Robinson said it would not be difficult to go back to requiring ballots arrive by 8 p.m. on Election Day. His biggest concern? Educating voters about that change. I'm Dirk Vanderhart reporting.
A debilitating disease has struck elk populations across the Northwest. Now, researchers have linked several types of bacteria to lesions on elk hooves. NWPB's senior environmental correspondent Courtney Flatt has more.
Elk hoof disease is pretty much what it sounds like. It's marked by painful lesions that make it hard for wild elk to move like normal. While it's not fatal, the deformities can make elk more susceptible to predators and hunters. Now, new research out of Washington State University's College of Veterinary Medicine has found that multiple bacteria are associated with the disease.
The better we can understand the bacterial populations within these lesions, the better we can understand what's actually causing them.
That's Liz Goldsmith. She's the lead author of the study. Goldsmith says that bacteria can be found in different areas throughout the disease's range, not just where it's most prevalent. She says scientists hope to eventually develop a rapid diagnostic test that could help wildlife management agencies. I'm Courtney Flatt.
Washington is the latest state to regulate artificial intelligence chatbots. Governor Bob Ferguson just signed a pair of bills aimed at reining in the new technology. KUOW's Monica Nicholsberg reports.
If you've ever seen something online and struggled to tell whether it was real or AI generated, Governor Ferguson is right there with you.
I'm confident I'm not the only Washingtonian who often sees something on my phone and wonder to myself,
exactly,
is that AI or is it real? And I feel like I'm a reasonably discerning person, and it is virtually impossible these days.
That's why Ferguson asked for a law that would require content that's been substantially modified with AI to make that information traceable. He also signed a bill that establishes new safeguards for people who use AI chatbots as companions. Things like notifying a user they're talking to a robot, not a human, and limiting conversations with minors that are sexually explicit or involve self-harm. Monica Nicholsberg, KUOW News.
Washington's first ever statewide survey of bees has found dozens of species new to the state. Several species have not been seen for a century or more. The state is home to at least 600 types of bees. Little is known about most of them. Carla Salp was one of the volunteers who went around netting and documenting rare bees for the Washington Department of Agriculture.
Some are extremely tiny. I'm talking about like 3 or 4 millimeters maybe. So people might see these things flying around and think that they're like gnats, and they're actually bees that are out there pollinating.
One small species of carpenter bee has not been seen in Washington since 1919 until this study turned it up. Wild insects pollinate more than $5 billion in crops annually in the U.S., from soybeans to strawberries. You're listening to local and regional news on KMUN. Have you ever listened to music and pictured shapes or colors in your mind? A local pianist and composer says that connection between sound and image can help musicians and listeners connect with music in a deeper way. KLCC's Kendra Schertl has more.
Alexander Schwarzkopf sits at his piano in his home studio in Eugene. The walls are covered with artwork. On one side, a large mural of an abstract geometric piano immediately draws the eye. Schwarzkopf describes it as the full spectrum of possibility realized.
You know, there's just this thing with realism and depicting objects and depicting things. I'm not interested in it. And I'm pulling between these two worlds. My fascination with geometric shapes, it's been a lifelong love, and I've always loved the work of the cubists and the expressionists.
Influenced by his artistic parents, Schwarzkopf's passion for the piano led him to graduate school, where he focused his research on something called structural interpretation. So what does that mean? On the page, music looks linear. Notes move from left to right, just like you're reading a book. But Schwarzkopf studies the physical movement, tone, pitch, and clusters of sound to uncover what he sees as the internal architecture of a piece.
Taking your hands away from the keyboard, experiencing the sound, visualizing it. What is the shape? What does it look like? Is it jagged? What kind of an expression does that suggest to you? I think that you can get a lot from attaching these multiple associations.
In 2022, Schwarzkopf was invited to compose for Portland's Macrocosmos Festival in honor of the late composer George Crumb. One of Crumb's best-known works, Macrocosmos, includes a piece called The Magic Circle of Infinity. Instead of traditional sheet music, it's written in a circle. In homage to Crumb, Schwarzkopf also designed a non-linear score to accompany his piece, Synergy.
I was composing the piece for at least a week or two before I even found the shape of the form I was using. And at one point in the composing process, I thought, I need to stop because I actually don't know what this is going to look like.
Inspired by the infinity symbol, he sketched a lily with 8 petals arranged in interlocking loops. When he placed the musical notes inside the design, everything fit perfectly.
There are things on this image that are certainly, they're derived from notation aspects, like these big beams around the sides. Those are actually beams on groups of sounds. And so some of them are actually slurs that connect other groups of sounds, but so they form a kind of way it looks.
Not all of Schwarzkopf's art uses musical notation directly. Some pieces are more abstract, using color and geometric shapes that almost resemble graphic scores. What sets his work apart from that modernist tradition is that the images don't replace the notes. Instead, they reveal the visual structure inside the sound. Of course, there isn't an exact formula for how art and music come together.
It all stems from seeing or hearing and responding. And it's rearranging and restructuring those pitches into textures, forms, and then what timbre, what kind of color, what depth, what density is it? Is it opaque? Does it need to have a little light coming through it? That tells you about your touch. That tells you about the kind of sounds. Are they high? Are they low? Are they this or that?
Over the years, Schwarzkopf has performed all over the world, producing and participating in experimental concerts, playing with 6 pianists at once, projecting his artwork while performing, and even giving concerts in complete darkness. After one performance, an audience member told him something that stuck with him.
Never has anybody said so clearly to me, I could see the sound. And that was when I know for sure that this exists in everyone.
For Schwarzkopf, studying music this way changes how it's played. Instead of focusing only on notes and rhythm, he encourages musicians and listeners to think beyond and deepen their connection to the story within.
To physically actually draw a color and commit a color to the page causes you to actually feel and think and go beyond your rational mind. No matter the level that you're at, I think that you can get a lot from attaching these multiple associations.
Back in his studio, surrounded by art and a mural of possibility, the boundary between sound and image begins to blur. And if you step into that realm of creativity and imagination, you might start to see it too. I'm Kendra Chertel in Eugene.
A new government report has found many military dogs live in substandard conditions. The Department of Defense Inspector General found sanitation issues and other problems in the kennels at 10 bases. Nationwide, the report blamed poor conditions for the deaths of 4 dogs. Steve Walsh reports for the American Homefront Project.
Chris Willingham spent nearly 20 years as a dog handler in the Marines before retiring in 2019 after multiple tours in Iraq and Afghanistan. He remembers being on a patrol south of Baghdad during the Iraq War when his dog Lucas reacted to the scent of explosives.
That's an area we were about to walk through without the detection capabilities of a military working dog. That was the first, but not the last time my dog saved my life.
He kept a picture of a fellow Marine standing in a crater 12 foot wide, 5 foot deep after the bomb was detonated.
We were all at a safe distance. No one was injured, but it was about 30 pounds of homemade explosives buried about a foot down.
Willingham is president of the U.S. War Dogs Association. It facilitates the adoption of dogs after they retire. He estimates 90% of the people who adopt the dogs are handlers. Willingham says that's one reason why he was surprised by a recent report by the Defense Department Inspector General that found dogs living in unsanitary conditions throughout the services.
I've not had that experience when I was in the Marine Corps. So it was pretty shocking to understand that those conditions were out there.
The Inspector General found that 4 dogs died from 2021 to 2023. Investigators found serious issues at 10 of the 12 facilities they visited. At Fort Bragg, North Carolina, and Joint Base Langley Fort Eustis in Virginia, inspectors found severe mold in the kennel buildings. Langley also had standing water mixed with feces. Handlers at Langley told inspectors that they couldn't get money in the defense budget to build new facilities. Willingham says kennel masters throughout the military are typically medium-grade staff sergeants and petty officers.
To get a new kennel facility or to get major work done, that's going to be well above a kennel master. Like, that's a little bit much to put on an individual handler when it comes to large-scale projects.
The Air Force trains working dogs for all of the services at Joint Base San Antonio-Lackland Air Force Base in Texas. Inspectors found that dogs in the training program were walked only 10 minutes four times a week. Short on staff, handlers tried to replace physical activity with audiobooks and scented bubbles. The Air Force acknowledges that three dogs died at their training facility. The Inspector General recommended the Air Force lower the number of dogs until more staff was hired. Spokesman for the Air Force says the service concurs with the recommendations of the IG report and is implementing the changes recommended. Dogs are used for a variety of tasks.
So a dog, you're right below the level of a weapon.
As a Marine at Camp Pendleton, California, explains in a 2009 military video.
Our dogs are trained on both detection as well as patrol works. So if you set something, say explosives, narcotics, anything of that sort you're not supposed to have aboard a Camp Pendleton installation, then they're going to find it.
Willingham says the U.S. War Dogs Association keeps tabs on military working dogs. They provide care packages for deploying teams. He says the number of teams surged during the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, but they have dipped in recent years. Last year, the Special Operations Command for the Marines shut down its dog program.
So whether it was IEDs, whether it was enemy personnel, their primary job just came back to saving lives and bringing people home. And the only reason I made it home was because of the dog that I had served with. So I can attest to their capabilities on the battlefield.
He says he's hopeful that the report's findings are not a sign that the services see its dog teams as a lower priority. In Norfolk, Virginia, I'm Steve Walsh.
Local and regional news on KMUN is brought to you by our news partners and by the KMUN News Department. If you have a news tip or story idea, email us at news1@kmun.org. That's news, the numeral 1, at kmun.org. American Democracy Minute is coming up next.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. During oral arguments in Watson versus Republican National Committee on March 23rd, the U.S. Supreme Court's majority appeared ready to end grace periods for mail-in ballots. A decision could come in early summer, 4 months before the midterm. Mississippi Solicitor General Scott Stewart, and briefed by pro-voter groups, argued that states were purposely given lawmaking flexibility by the U.S. Constitution and Congress hadn't changed the law. 14 states have grace periods for eligible regular ballots mailed before Election Day, and 29 states for UOCAVA ballots from military and overseas voters. Arguing for the Mississippi Republican Party, former U.S. Solicitor General Paul Clement argued that historically, most states recognized that Election Day was the day by which all ballots must be received and counted, and states took, quote, Herculean steps to get ballots returned by Election Day during the Civil War. Justices Thomas, Alito, and Gorsuch seem to agree. Justice Kagan asked Clement how, if Congress limited receipt of ballots to Election Day, could early voting be justified. Clement suggested it had a separate history. A decision is likely in late June or early July, requiring another Herculean effort by states to communicate the changes before November 3rd. We've linked the transcript and more at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal.
You're listening to KMUN. We just wrapped up our spring pledge drive here at the station, but it's never too late to help support your local community radio station. You can give us a call at 503-325-0010, or you can go to our website, kmun.org, and click on the red donate button. Thank you so much to everyone who stepped up during the pledge drive to support us with your donations and to our volunteers who are manning the phone lines and putting out great shows on the airwaves. This radio station has been here for more than 40 years. It was built by the community, for the community. And we hope to be with you for decades to come. This is KMUN.